Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works. Michael, today we're going to talk about an issue that is very topical and one that a lot of people have kind of asked us what we think about it, and that's just the issue of civility.
Or the lack thereof.
Exactly, right. There's a lot of stories, a lot of examples, a lot of reason why people are thinking about this right now,
and can't imagine why that would be.
Right. And obviously, it's a pretty important issue for democracy. So today we have Timothy Schaefer, who's an assistant professor of communication studies at Kansas State University in beautiful downtown Manhattan, Kansas. He's also the assistant director of the Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy at K-State, and also the editor of a new book, Crisis in Civility.
Well, before we get to Professor Schaefer, why do you think civility is important to democracy? Or let me put it this way. Do you think civility is essential to democracy?
I do.
Why is that?
I think that civilization and civility have the same root, the same Latin root, civitas. And it's hard to see how you can have the former and not have the latter or whatever. You can't have civilization without civility, I guess.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning, well, look, let's say that what it's not. Civility doesn't mean just being polite. It doesn't mean being nice. It means treating all your fellow citizens with a kind of mutual respect. And actually, civitas in Latin does mean, refers back to citizenship. It means befitting a citizen. So I think it is, as long as we understand that civility means treating everyone with a kind of mutual respect, then I do think it's necessary because you can't really have an argument then. And without an argument, you don't really have a democracy. I think, you don't have to agree. And as we've said, many times, if you're going to have a democracy, you have to assume that disagreement is inescapable. But in the midst of that, we have to live together. And so the one way that we do that is by accepting the legitimacy of other people with points of views that are different from our own.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting within governing institutions, like, for example, within legislatures, within Congress, there are all kinds of rules and norms that are intended to preserve a sort of civility.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It is, for example, a violation of I can't remember if this is in the House, it is a violation of congressional rules to personally insult another member of the chamber.
Right.
Right. They always refer to one another as Mr. or Mrs.
Right. And they'll often say, and I think this is not a rule, but they will frequently refer to other people on people on the other side of the aisle as my good friend.
Or the honorable, right. Mm-hmm. Or even if they really can't stand
it. Right.
And these are all intended to introduce a measure of civility right. into our public discussions.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree. And the book Crisis in Civility speaks exactly to this. We're in a new climate and, you know, Timothy's job is to try to figure out how to get us out of it.
So let's turn to Jenna for the interview.
Sounds good.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Tim Schaefer. Tim, thanks for joining us on Democracy Works.
Thanks for having me.
So civility is one of those terms that means something different to everyone, I think. And you've just edited a book on the topic that gives two definitions. One is civility as responsiveness, and the other is civility as politeness. Can you explain what those mean and how those two definitions might interact with each other?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity to do that. The longer answer to your relatively easy question is that we didn't necessarily say here is the single notion, but in the chapter that you referenced by Anthony Layden, who is a philosopher, he lays out these kind of two concepts of civility, and he has this important distinction between talking about civility as kind of politeness and then civility as kind of responsiveness. Which is really helpful because as someone who studies this work and engages it in practical situations and settings, it's important that we think about civility as being more than just kind of minding your manners or abiding by the rules or the expectations of kind of a dominant society. There have been some really great recent articles, for example, about civility on NPR, and they... some of the recent ones have really attended to one of the big concerns that we've had and that I personally have as someone who studies and researches this is that what does civility mean when we think about it through that kind of traditional paradigm of kind of politeness and being kind and courteous to folks? What does that mean to those who are on the margins or who are excluded from kind of the dominant expression of a culture or a society?
So I've seen a lot of calls on social media and elsewhere to revive civility. That's a hashtag I see all the time. And I'm wondering how you can go about doing that, about reviving something, if there's no clear consensus about what civility is in the first place.
Yeah. And I would say somewhat of an analog to that is the language of civic renewal, which gets used quite a bit. The spaces that I exist in, but it begs for, I think, more consideration, because if we're trying to revive something or trying to renew something, it presupposes that there was something in the past. And I think part of the Revive Civility campaign from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, I think, is rooted more in this notion that we have in recent times seen the increases in various studies and people's experience, right? So it's not just something we have to find from research, but people are recognizing, noticing that politicians, as well as just folks in their neighborhoods and in their communities, are really ratcheting up some of the kind of partisan divisions and rancor. So for us to think about kind of reclaiming something, it's more, how do we step back a little bit from maybe this more kind of extreme precipice where we seem to be situated right now, rather than saying there was a particular golden age of civility, because I mean, and rightfully so, the critics of civility would say, yeah, we could say we followed the rules and we kind of maintained those expectations of how we would engage in public discourse or discussion, whether in Congress or elsewhere. But you know, there were only certain people who were doing that or who were allowed to do that. And so I think that critique is important. And this is part of what makes this work challenging. And in some ways, I think civility is not always my first go-to or preferred term for what I do, because I think in the bigger sense, it's more about civic life and engaging in kind of a bigger notion of what it means to be able to collaborate and work across difference, rather than simply saying, are we following the rules that we've either predetermined or have been determined for us from outside forces?
What role does nostalgia play here? I think you could read calls to revive civility as coming from the same rhetorical playbook as Donald Trump's Make America Great Again. So how do you kind of get past that feeling that we need to look backwards and move toward a more forward-looking view of civility?
Yeah, I would totally agree. And that could have been the third example there of that kind of sense of trying to reclaim something, because then it becomes the question of like, well, okay, was the 1950s that were the good time? Who were the people that were benefiting and profiting, and who were the folks that were not even on the map, literally, when we start talking about things like redlining and otherwise. And so so for us, I think the notion of particularly this book, A Crisis of Civility, it did emerge, I should say, right from work that the National Institute for Civil Discourse recognized and supported with external support as well, right? So lots of institutions saying that these are important questions to be asking right now, and only, I would say, more timely since the time that we were first meeting in the spring of 2017, when the origins of this book kind of took place. Because we are seeing and continue to see, right? There's this never-ending cycle of where is the bottom for our current state of political discourse. But in fact, we've seen some really significant impacts. So in Maine, for example, they've gone through the Next Generation program, and it has really transformed how legislators operate and engage with one another. That in otherwise really contentious kind of partisan times, here's a path and opportunity for them to step back a little bit and reflect on, who are they? What are they doing? A lot of it's built around this notion of building trust, right? So if we can step back from this notion of thinking about of politics as being on a team and I'm red and you're blue and those kinds of things, then we have the opportunity for more potential there. And so the Next Generation program has been collaborating with the networks across the country for state legislators and all sorts of things. And it's been really exciting to see kind of blossom in some significant ways, because I think even those in an elected office see that the issues that they're trying to champion and advocate for often require some degree of support from those who would be, quote, on the other side. And so how do we help create some of those conditions for that to be more productive?
So you just mentioned two groups of people there, politicians and everyday citizens. Do you have a sense of where the need for civility and civil discourse is greater between those two groups?
I think this is one of the dilemmas that we face, is that we're seeing it showing up in all of these environments, right? The expectations, kind of the norms. If C-SPAN just celebrated its anniversary just a couple of days ago, right? And so I've been watching some of these historical clips of some of these more exciting exchanges between people, right? But, there are expectations of how you operate in those deliberative bodies, ideally those deliberative bodies. So I think there's something that's really significant that needs to happen in that space, because part of the process, the intensity of money in politics and gerrymandering, the factors that have put us kind of on this path to solidifying more kind of extreme positions. I mean, we see it from Pew and others, the kind of movement of the centers of these parties to more polarized times. That's very real. And at the same time, frankly, the space that I exist in and where I work and what I study is more localized. It's in communities. It's in local government settings. One of the projects that I'm working on right now with a number of colleagues is really exploring what are possibilities at the local level with city managers and mayors, others kind of at that level of politics is really significant. But also even more than that for me is exploring this in the kind of the third spaces, right? The environments where people are not in some official capacity, but are simply, and I say simply, not as a derogative here, but it's important for us to say, how do we actually engage each other in everyday life and kind of everyday talk in ways that are more respectful and civil, right? So there are those terms, but also productive, and also environments that are able to hold the important tensions that exist in civic life. We've had recent discussions here in Kansas on the concealed handgun law that changed a couple years ago, right? So there are really important topics that we need to be confronting and thinking about. But if we don't have opportunities or the spaces to do that, then I think we're really in a tough spot. And that's why the work that I do with the National Institute for Civil Discourse to me is so important, because there's this kind of national overlay that happens there. But also with my appointment here at Kansas State University and our Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy is putting that into practice, both locally in the community where I am, as well as statewide. We need to be engaging those who are these representatives who kind of show up on the national landscape and talking about politics. But we also need to reclaim politics as something that we do in our communities, with people, in relationship. And when I hear it quite a bit from students, they're like, oh, I'm not into politics, right? Because they only think about that as happening in Capitol buildings, whether it's in Topeka or Washington, D.C. But we need to kind of recalibrate that in a significant way if we're going to kind of see ourselves out of the times that we're in right now.
So something I think that's brought up as a critique of those deliberations you just mentioned is, how do you turn those conversations into policy? The discussion in and of itself is good to help people develop a sense of empathy and maybe hear things from a different point of view. But I think people can also get turned off if they don't see those discussions leading to tangible changes. So how do you reconcile those two things and start to bring together the act of deliberation with more substantive policy changes?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, you know, a few people come to mind and some projects, and I'll speak to a colleague of yours there at Penn State, John Gastel, who he and many others work in efforts like the Citizens Initiative Review to embed these kinds of deliberative practices into formal policy processes. So, you know, CIR creates those kinds of conditions where ordinary people come together and hear kind of expert testimony, kind of wrestle through ideas that are going to show up on a ballot initiative. And at the end of a few days, a very intensive few days, and a very structured few days, they come out and make these statements about how they have come to either agreement, and usually there's never kind of unanimity to kind of the decision, but there is an opportunity for us to see a framing of issues that is outside of just the kind of expert paradigm, or that is being communicated to us through advertising or whoever's got kind of funding. You know, there are those types of things that that are happening that I think demonstrate the possibility. But I hear it quite a bit, right? Especially as I'm working with younger people, and they are saying, so what, right? So we've talked about this. And I think that's an important thing for us, especially as a field for dialogue and deliberation, to say, how do we translate this kind of everyday talk into actual policy decisions? And maybe I'll offer, this is not a contemporary example, but a historical one, because I think it makes this point. One line of my research looks at the 1930s and 40s, a program that was run through the USDA and through the land grant and cooperative extension system. So they created these discussion guides on a whole host of topics, things like soil erosion and taxes and imports, tensions between urban and rural communities, all of these types of things. And in one breath, that was done simply as a chance for people to engage in discussion. One of the leaders of the project talked about discussion being the archstone of democracy, right? But they also paired that with a formal process that was being done at the time for land use planning, right? So the people who were part of the land use planning boards, if you will, at the local level, that then had influence on regional and state, and then finally kind of national policy, we're grounded in these kind of deliberative and kind of dialogic principles. So when we think about that bridge between kind of everyday talk and policy decisions, I think it's really important for us to say, how do we actually do some of that? Sometimes talk is really important, and that's where the expectation should reside, that we need to just understand either one another or the topic before we just immediately move to action. But that bridging to policy, I think, is a really important concern. And if we have opportunities to formalize that, and in fact, a lot of that can happen at local levels, right? So you can have a level of buy-in from, say, a city council in contrast to, say, a state legislative body. And for me, that point of entry is much more both accessible but also possible in really significant ways.
I'm reminded of a conversation that we had on this show earlier this season with Jonathan Heights. We talked about free expression of ideas, and he cites Mills on Liberty, which I believe you cite in your book as well. And I'm wondering what the right balance is between civility and free expression, and how do you set up environments where people can express their ideas freely but in a civil way?
Yeah, I mean, this is a hugely important issue, and I mean, it can be seen as this tension. And in my mind, this is where process really matters, right? So, an element of the work that I do here at Kansas State with our Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy, we have established ground rules that we utilize in virtually any kind of public discussion or setting, and it speaks to some themes like seeking understanding, expect and explore conflicting viewpoints, right? Giving people opportunities to speak, but also listen respectfully and thoughtfully, offer and examine support for those claims, right? So it can be experiential, or it can be some kind of data point that's outside of your own kind of lived experience. But it's important to acknowledge that, and appreciating communication differences, things like that. The tension between free speech and this notion of civility, I don't think has to be kind of it's over here or it's over there. The capacity to create conditions for kind of expression of contentious views is really important. I think where we start to see some rub is the expectation of kind of quote safe spaces. Where if people are feeling uncomfortable or maybe even challenged or attacked, that, you know, if we set that as a ground rule, for example, that is going to become a very significant tension that we have to acknowledge. And so for me, I don't actually use that language of saying this will be a safe space, because our public life is not safe for many of us. And I think we need to step into that and wrestle with that and acknowledge it, and then figure out how do we engage in some conversation that is helpful and constructive in significant ways, but it doesn't necessarily have to be restrictive in those ways. With all that, but with all that said, right, there are some baselines that we have to abide by beyond saying, like, you know, expect conflict and give people chances to speak. If you don't acknowledge my right to exist as a human, that doesn't work very well, right? That's outside of those kind of bounds. And that's partly why we need to have some of this. When people are just kind of yelling and lobbing, attacks at one another, that's not helpful. And at the same time, how do we step into some environment, whether it's, you know, literally face to face in a conversation, or it's online, or whatever the venue might be, that gets us out of the ability to just kind of attack each other? And that's, for me, where I think the dialogue deliberation work becomes really important.
I don't think anyone would disagree that when it comes to civility, President Trump is a model of what not to do. So given that, who do you point to as a model for how people should behave when it comes to practicing civility in politics?
Oh, that's a good question. And it's funny, I don't have an immediate go-to as kind of like, here's the classic example of someone who ought to be our kind of exemplar. But, just given the state of things as they have been recently, and it seems like it will continue for a bit, I will point to someone like, you know, Senator John McCain as someone, and we've seen this from a lot of figures who have now left elected office in recent years, is the notion that you can still have you can have your strong views, but you can engage and recognize when you need to give a little bit, or also when you might be wrong. You know, David Brooks kind of famously not too long ago came out and wrote an essay on reparations and basically said, yeah, what I used to think, I don't think that anymore. Right. And we're not often afforded the opportunity to see people in public life step back and say that thing that I thought strongly about previously, I've taken in more information, I've reflected on it, I've thought about it, and now I come to this place. We don't have a lot of good examples of that, honestly, and I think that's part of our dilemma. So that's, you know, part of, back to your comment earlier about, you know, what are we trying to revive or what are we trying to reclaim? I think there's a desire to get to some level of normalcy, normal behavior in this kind of environment of a frankly a new normal as it seems to be.
So I'm reminded too of an episode that we did last year with Laurie Mulvey, who directs the World in Conversation program at Penn State. The episode is called A Conversation About Conversation. We'll link to it in the show notes. But Laurie in that episode talked about the need for facilitators in these discussions as a way to maintain that sense of civility and, you know, help people appreciate other perspectives. And I'm curious what role you think facilitators play in deliberative democracy.
Having kind of the conditions for informal everyday political talk is really important, right? And increasingly we're losing kind of those third spaces where people do that. We talked about libraries a little bit ago. You know, there's that new book, Palaces for the People, that argues why we need kind of social infrastructure if we're going to think about things like social capital. And for me, that all is part of our conversation about kind of a civic ecosystem. That we need to have opportunities for just the daily interactions with neighbors, those that we work with that show up if we show up in places like churches on the weekends, right? Those kinds of environments. That's really important. But I would agree, right, with the point that facilitators are really important and really helpful if we are going to get to that level of having kind of discussion be constructive and engaging in the ways that are essential and necessary for democratic life. And so that's one of the things that is built into almost everything that I teach. I teach both undergraduate and graduate students. I direct a program called Dialogue, Deliberation, and Public Engagement. So it's a professional certificate program. And we've had people from federal and state agencies, people from the nonprofit world, as well as, you know, just kind of ordinary folks in communities who are interested in really learning the different process models and then frankly, how to facilitate that. So I think the role of facilitators is an essential one. And I'll borrow a phrase, a colleague of mine, Martine Carcassin at Colorado State, he has been using and kind of coined with Leah Sprain, who's now at Boulder, but passionate impartiality, right? So this role of facilitators being passionate, I mean, this is going to sound slightly silly, but right, passionate about process, passionate about democratic practices actually being put into play and realized with people. And at the same time, recognizing that if you're going to pull that off, you need to do it in a way that has you stepping back from being kind of a participant and a contributor to that conversation. So I have really strong views. I have a file cabinet with bumper stickers from many years that lives in a closet at home because I choose not to have it in my office here, because part of what I do and what I teach is not being that person, right? Necessarily being that kind of advocate for the things that I feel strongly about. But what I do, and many others in this world of dialogue and deliberation, what we do is prepare students and others to use this work.
So, Tim, we're going to end now, as we always do, with our four Mood of the Nation poll questions. So thinking specifically about American politics, what makes you angry?
I think the level of acceptance that what is happening right now is how we ought to let things be.
What makes you proud?
That there are people who are investing a lot of time and energy and resources into trying to cultivate a more democratic expression of shared life.
What makes you worry?
The first question. The sense that that as I experience being in a classroom and I have small children, that the way that they hear and consume news about politics is the only way that they think it might exist, and that they don't have good examples of alternatives to kind of the new normal.
And finally, what gives you hope?
The fact that in spite of the significant challenges, that in the most basic way, if we are to live well with one another, we need to recognize humanity in people. And I see that and I experience it when you actually get to a place of creating these kinds of opportunities for democratic discussion. There's a space where people, even though they have strong animosity towards the views that someone else might hold, they can see underneath that a bit of the veneer and recognize that there's some humanity underneath there.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for helping us understand what civility is and how we can all practice it in our everyday discourse. So thanks for joining us on Democracy Works.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Well, that was certainly very interesting, but I do feel like we need to address the elephant in the room.
And that elephant would live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
The one who called his former Secretaries of State dumb as a rock.
Yeah, yeah. Timothy was a little reluctant to, you know, to call that out, but I just don't think it's impossible to talk about a decline in civility without talking about
that.
Donald
is the
Trump.
Question.
The president is the only person in United States politics that everyone votes for. And it's the only one that really represents the United States of America as a single person. And what he or she does and says matters in terms of the climate of the culture, the political culture at large. And so it's unrealistic to think that the behavior of the commander-in-chief, you know, the occupier of the bully pulpit, is not going to affect the behavior and attitudes of ordinary citizens.
Well, and it's also the fact that he relies for presidential communications on a medium which is sort of designed to be uncivil.
Or at least it facilitates incivility.
At least it facilitates
right.
it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Twitter is not really a great place to have a
thoughtful discussion. People do it. And I admire them for it, but yeah, it's hard.
It does, but it also lends itself to trolling and to
sure.
insults, and
mm-hmm.
and this is his preferred right. means of communication
yeah.
with
his
the
métier.
With the American people. Are we seeing the effects? Are we seeing trickle down effects? Do you think? From
I
the
think
president?
Absolutely we are. I mean, you know, whether or you know, there's. I saw a study that said that. Where Trump has had rallies, there's been an increase in terms of hate crimes, right?
In those communities.
Right, in those communities. And so that would be the most extreme level. It's hard to believe that this doesn't have an impact, right? If it's okay for the president to talk this way, why is it not okay for me to talk this way? I don't know what the answer to that is. I think it's only fair for us to bring up the issue of incivility on that the right routinely brings up, which is, you know, Maxine Waters and others in the Democratic House arguing that it's okay to interrupt the dinner of Kristen, what's her name, Nielsen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
others.
And others.
And others.
Sarah Sanders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember when Jonathan Haidt was here a few weeks ago, he made a point of saying that's wrong.
Right. Right.
It's hard to argue with that.
Right. And so the argument, you know, or the kind of line that I think needs to be made here is, you know, whenever you think circumstances justify you being uncivil, you you should be damn sure that that's an appropriate response, and understand that you what it is you are risking in order to do that, right? So, you know, there are people who would say, look, you know, the Trump administration is putting children in cages, therefore incivility is justified. There are people who would say, you know, abortion is murder of a child, therefore incivility is justified. You know, there are people who would, who are quite ready to make that judgment. All I'm saying is I think you ought to make darn sure that you are understanding the consequences of your action if you do that. So I think it is interesting, and in this context relevant to talk about what Tim and others are doing about this, right? They're coming up with these, you know, revive civility campaigns and other efforts to bring citizens into you know, new mechanisms by which reviving, they can talk to each other.
Reviving suggests old mechanisms.
Yeah, that's right.
Reviving suggests bringing back something from the past.
That's true. They're trying to do new ways to bring back what they thought was better established in eras past.
Yeah, so make America great by reviving civility.
Yeah, I don't think they would. I don't think Timothy would frame it that
way. Well, I'm being somewhat facetious.
Yeah,
but part of my point about changes in the party system and the way people have sorted themselves out is that just talking about going back to the past might be a little bit unrealistic.
I think that's right.
We're in a different age. Mm-hmm. We're in an age not only of entirely different kinds of technologies, mm-hmm. as we've talked about, but also a party system that is, under its current design, accentuates the divisions among people and therefore makes it all the more difficult.
It makes these efforts, you know, deliberative efforts seem so minimal. You know, I mean, you're it's just a tiny little effort when, you know, the bullhorn, the megaphone of the presidency is just always and so loudly pushing in the other direction. So, I mean, it just remains to be seen. Clearly, the issue is not going away. And it seems like there's a lot here. I mean, we may want to address this, you know, again going forward, because I do think that people, it's something that people are concerned about. And I don't know that we have any real idea as to how we get out of this, right? I mean, you know, the one thing Timothy Schaefer and others are doing is saying, well, here's a strategy. See what you think of this.
Well, a important topic. We'll be back to it. And our thanks to Timothy for raising these issues.
And to Jenna for yet another really terrific interview. So,
from the McCourney Institute for Democracy, I'm Michael Burke.
And I'm Chris Beam. Thanks for listening.
Democracy Works is produced by the McCourney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Penn State. Our hosts are Michael Berkman, Chris Beam, and me, Jenna Spinelli. Andy Grant is our engineer, and Mark Stitzer is our editor. Additional support comes from Emily Reddy, Shireen Stanford, Craig Johnson, and the rest of the team at WPSU. For detailed show notes and discussion questions for each episode, visit our website at democracyworkspodcast.com. And if you like what you heard today, please consider rating or reviewing us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.